You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of February, 2012, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One with me, Nancy Durham. One Qantas Airbus is grounded after cracks are found on the wings. We'll ask how this affects the future of the Super Jumbo. We'll discuss China's historic valuable artifacts, which are in grave danger. Archaeologists say 44,000 heritage sites have disappeared over the past 20 years. Others are being looted by real-life tomb raiders. And NASA is sifting through the greatest number of astronaut applications since the 70s. Could it be the financial crisis has made jobs in space more attractive than ever? This and a lot more on Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham. First, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Syrian forces thrust into the rebellious city of Homs today, killing as many as 100 civilians. And Turkey appeared to be preparing a new diplomatic push against President Assad. Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan, who's readying an initiative uniting Western, Arab and other states, which have called for Ankara's former ally Assad to step down, was due to speak to the Russian President Dmitry Medvedev later today. In the latest assault, troops fired rockets and mortars while tanks entered the Inchart neighbourhood and moved closer to Bab Amru, the district hardest hit by bombardments that have killed nearly 200 people in the last 2 days. This activist in Homs says there's no going back now.
We will go on until death. The government, if they don't listen to us, we want freedom. And we are still going out and asking for it peacefully, and they're killing us.
Greek parties are trying to agree a reform deal in return for a new EU-IMF rescue to avoid a chaotic default after repeated delays, which have prompted warnings that the euro can live without Athens. With the future of Greece and the wider eurozone at stake, Prime Minister Lukas Papademos' efforts to get the three parties in his government to accept the tough reforms demanded by the European Union and the IMF seem to have been thwarted by arguments over little more than procedural matters. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel says her support for Greece remains 100%.
Der Euro ist nicht nur ein ökonomisches Projekt, er ist auch ein politisches Projekt.
The Euro is not just an economic project, it is also a political project. I will have no part in forcing Greece out of the Euro. It would have unforeseeable consequences.
But a public opinion poll published in Greece showed Greeks have lost faith in the main political parties and want elections after a roller coaster ride of austerity measures, political infighting and dithering on decisions. Political analyst George Zokopoulos.
People are totally angry and disappointed with Greek politicians, and they see no alternative which can guarantee a better future for them and for their life. That is why they do not trust them any longer.
The new president of the Maldives has stressed that he did not take power in the Indian Ocean resort islands in a coup and said that his succession was in line with the constitution. The Maldives, one of the world's most famous luxury tourist destinations, installed Mohammed Wahid Hassan Manik as president yesterday after the man credited with bringing democracy to the islands resigned, apparently under military pressure following a police mutiny. Today, the new president spoke to reporters.
President Nasheed is responsible for his actions. I am not answerable to them. I advised the president against it. I came out when the president did not take my advice. I came out openly.
Supporters and exiled Tibetans gathered in Taipei today to pray for Tibet, where a series of self-immolations and sporadic protests have prompted China to step up security. China defended its shooting of Tibetan protesters, saying that a string of protests and self-immolations in Tibetan areas were masterminded by forces trying to split the country. A suspected suicide car bomber killed at least 9 people today near a hotel where lawmakers often gather in the Somali capital Mogadishu. A police officer said so far we've carried 9 dead civilians and 34 others injured. Up to now we've not seen casualties of any legislators. The death toll may rise. European air safety officials have extended checks for Airbus A380 wing cracks to the entire Super Jumbo fleet and said the widespread defects could pose a safety risk if left unremedied. The move to inspect all 68 A380s in service came as Qantas Airways grounded one of its planes for up to a week following the discovery of 36 separate cracks in wing parts. And the Vega rocket will blast off from French Guiana on Monday, an inaugural flight aimed at giving Europe a vehicle for scientific satellite missions, the first new rocket Europe has developed since the mid-1990s. The liftoff is scheduled for 10 GMT from the European Space Agency's launch centre in Kourou, French Guiana, on the northeast coast of South America. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
And thank you, Nick. Now it's a time for looking at the global weather around the world with Tomasz Szafranaker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And the deep freeze in Europe is so severe now that it's actually the harshest winter spell for over 20 years. Through Wednesday and Thursday, fresh, heavy snowfall for southeastern Europe. In eastern countries like Ukraine, daytime highs will be around minus 20 degrees again. In fact, more cold air will be flooding deep into the European continent over the coming days. Further west across Europe, a little snow in Germany and Austria. Not especially heavy, though, not at this stage. Thursday's city outlook: in London, 2 degrees, partly cloudy. In Munich, minus 5 and snow. Helsinki is minus 8 with clouds. And in Nice, 8 degrees and sunny. In North America now, the weather is still at a standstill. We have a giant air of high pressure across the US. This basically means that nothing is moving. It's very settled, very calm. Some temporary changes, though, on the way for the Great Lakes and eastern parts of Canada. Just a little snow end of the week, but that's all. After that, cold and sunny again. Thursday's city outlook: Montreal, minus 2, partly cloudy. New York City, 7 and sunny. Indianapolis, 5 degrees, clouds in the sky. And in Los Angeles, Thursday is looking very warm, 25 degrees with sunshine. Other world centres now: in the Middle East, in Cairo, it's 17 degrees. It'll stay like that in northern Egypt for the rest of the week. And into the weekend, in Tel Aviv, somewhat cooler, around 15 here, fairly cloudy. In Asia, Bangkok, the usual thunder showers, around 35. In Hong Kong, 19 and cloudy. That's all. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Szafranaker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomasz. At 7 minutes past the hour, you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 Tagatia. Yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e io cosa?
Tema on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle
24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Qantas Airways has grounded one of its fleet of 12 Airbus 380s after it was discovered to have 36 cracks in its wings. Well, meantime, European air authorities have now ordered that all 68 double-decker super jumbos be checked. Well, Bloomberg business correspondent Andrea Rothman joins us on the line now from Paris. Good evening, Andrea.
Hi, good evening.
Well, this is huge bad news for this super jumbo.
It depends how you look at it. I mean, actually, no, it's not that big a deal technically. What happened is that they found these hairline cracks after initially inspecting a Qantas aircraft about a year ago that had an engine explode on the wing. That was serious. But in this case, they say it comes from a manufacturing defect, and in fact, they understand what's wrong with it, and they're simply going to go back on the new planes and manufacture things in a different way. On the older planes, they have a fix for it, and they're going to put that into service. As far as the passengers are concerned, however, many people don't understand necessarily the difference between small cracks and bigger cracks or structural problems. So I think they have some work in explaining to the public exactly what this is.
Can you help with that? I know you're not speaking on their behalf, but I'd like to know, as someone who flies, the difference between little cracks and big ones.
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, there are sort of ribs within the wing, thousands of ribs that can connect one part of the wing to the other. And some of these have just developed cracks from a combination of factors, all of which are related to where they manufactured the wing in the first place. I mean, part of it is that they used an aluminum alloy, which is a mix of aluminum and other materials that was different from the usual aluminum they used. Part of it is the way that they actually shoved the fasteners or the bolts through holes. And then part of it is the stresses that came when they put the whole wing together. And these all combined so that over time, when you flew the plane for a couple of months or longer than that, you would develop tiny, tiny cracks in some of the wing ribs, but it wasn't sufficient actually to put the plane in danger. So while it's something that has to be treated, the EASA, or the European Air Safety Authority, is not saying you've got to ground all these planes now and fix it right away. They're giving people several weeks or several months, depending upon the specific airplane, to fix this.
So that's a good indication. If they're not concerned enough to say stay on the ground, well, passengers should try not to be as well.
Right, you have to look at the directive. I mean, if there were a really serious problem with any plane, they would not allow the plane to fly, simply because they would have to fix it before you took to the air again. But they're saying this is something that over time could create problems with the plane, but it would be perhaps a series of several years before you actually got to the point where you were threatening the plane. So what they're doing is they're setting out a program saying, by such and such a date, according to how long you've been flying the plane, you have to do something about this, you have to fix it, but it's not by any means a panic situation, even though It's mysterious to the public, and it can be frightening because people aren't used to hearing about cracks, when in fact most planes develop cracks over time.
Okay. This is also, help me with understanding it further, in that this is a very new aircraft, right? It's only been around for a few years?
Yeah, that's true.
And this is the big super jumbo, so all our listeners can picture it, right? This is the biggest thing flying around out there, correct?
That's true. I mean, we're talking about a double-decker aircraft that normally seats about 500, 550 people, but that can seat as many as 873 people. So it is the biggest single commercial airliner ever, topping the 747, which used to be the queen of the skies. That's a Boeing plane that sat about 450 people. So obviously Airbus has a lot at stake with this plane and a big reputation to protect, because it's a very well-noticed plane. It's kind of like the Concorde. I mean, there's so few of them out there. There's 68, whereas you have thousands and thousands of 737s or A320s in the case of Airbus, that everything that happens to the plane people really look at closely, especially since a lot of these airlines like Emirates, Singapore, use this as their flagship product to really attract passengers.
So that's where there could be some damage. Passengers backing off a little bit, do you think?
It's conceivable. I mean, it depends on the passengers. I think generally the more sophisticated the passengers, I mean, business passengers who are used to flying all the time, who probably read a lot more about how planes work and what happens, may shrug it off a lot more easily than someone who's perhaps flown only a couple of times in their life and is thinking of booking a trip and might say, I'm not comfortable because I heard that this plane has cracks. But I think if you look at the bookings, I think there probably is, a negligible effect at this point. I mean, again, many planes from time to time develop problems that you'll read about. I mean, the 787 as well, Boeing's new plane, has developed some smaller problems that they're working on, but that's not a reason not to get on the plane.
Sure. You are actually rather reassuring on this. You should do airline fear of flying courses.
I could teach that to my husband, actually, who's not comfortable flying.
So, and there's no reason to. Just there's a statistic, something like 250-odd of these super jumbos are on order from 19 different customers. No reason to think those orders won't just be flying ahead.
No, I don't think so. In fact, we called several of the companies today to say, look, are you still on board for this order, including British Airways, which has, I think, a dozen, I'm not sure, maybe planes on order. And they said no. I mean, in fact, the planes that have not yet been manufactured and that will be going to these future airlines will not even have this problem, because they will have corrected the manufacturing fix by that time.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking us through this.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Bye for now.
Good night.
Good night. Andrea Rothman of Bloomberg talking with us from Paris. We have a song for you now by Oland, and I believe it's called White Nights. And that was Oland with White Nights. Headline here for you. Chinese archaeologists say 44,000 historic heritage sites have disappeared in the country over the past 20 years alone. In just a moment, we're going to be talking with a historian about how to stop the looting.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle Cafe and Shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the Peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, The Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marinucci. For more details, visit monocle.com.
For a complete briefing on the business of design, join us for Section D. Every week, Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, brings you the world of design in a perfectly formed package, looking at architecture, industrial design, fashion, retail, and graphics. Monocle 24's Section D brings the world of design to you, the Monocle listener. That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
China's heritage, as we are told, is being plundered across the country. In China, archaeologists there have estimated that during the last 20 years, more than 40,000 historic heritage sites have disappeared in the country. I'm joined now, I'm delighted to say, by Shane McCausland. He is the senior lecturer in the history of Chinese art at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, or SOAS, who people who are familiar with your institute might call it. Welcome.
Thank you.
Take us to China. You've been there. You've seen firsthand something of what's going on. Is it as dire as this? It sounds
pretty
shocking.
I think you have to believe what they say. If this information comes from the State Administration of Cultural Heritage, you know, it's their responsibility to look after any site that's discovered. And of course, there's so much being discovered at the moment because of the pace of development. You know, so many roads, railways, buildings are being built. And what happens is, you know, someone breaks the ground and they discover a tomb. There's heritage in there.
Is it sort of dime a dozen attitude over there a little bit?
That's hard to say that. I mean, a lot of these sites are in very remote places. The really, you know, the big headline sites, yes, of course, they're beautifully cared for. And they get, you know, hundreds, thousands, if not millions of visitors. They're beautifully looked after, new buildings and, you know, beautifully prepared, manicured. And research goes on about them. But it's I guess they're really pointing to hundreds, thousands of sites in very remote places where, you know, they're very cut off. They might be very far away from the local administration. And, you know, who knows what happens?
But the sheer numbers, tens of thousands of sites. So my silly quip, dime a dozen, it's just everywhere you dig something up, you find something that is a treasure. And it must be rather overwhelming.
Well, yes, there is a lot, but I think, I'm not an archaeologist, but from what I hear from colleagues, that relatively speaking, actually, the amount of treasures coming out of the ground in China is relatively less than, say, we have from ancient Britain. But maybe that will change over time if, as more and more is discovered. China is an enormous country.
Right. I've walked around some of it. But I'm also reading about these gangs of tomb raiders who are going into places, taking things, sending them out via Hong Kong, Macau, over to Canada, the U.S., to Europe, whatever. What do you know about these gangs or how it works, what's happening?
The heyday of that, I think, has passed a bit, partly because in America, the United States, the law was passed that objects without provenance couldn't so easily be bought and sold, especially by museums. But, I worked in Hong Kong in the early 90s in the auction house. And, yeah, I suppose that was the heyday. And, you know, there were almost kind of sort of funny stories around, like when the weather was extremely hot in Hong Kong, they would say that, you know, the supply of artifacts coming from the mainland would dry up. And people say, well, why is that? And they'd say, oh, well, it's very uncomfortable to be working down inside a tomb when the weather's unbearably hot. So they would kind of down tools. And this, you know, that was the kind of folklore that went along with it. Yes, there's a lot of corruption at different levels in China. And so it depends, you know, whether local officials are going to, there will be cases where local officials are bent and they are in cahoots with gangs and will siphon objects that are discovered in their areas. But, you know, to give them their due, the state administration are very harsh when they clamp down on this kind of thing. You know, they take their job, this responsibility, very seriously. I've seen it.
What do they do?
Well, you know, right, they're in the Ministry of Culture in Beijing, but, you know, the decisions that they're making are national ones. It's very difficult for them in Beijing to, you know, to see that the minutiae of policy or directives are being carried out at the most local level, because these are very, very remote places.
Across this vast country, as you have said. So then, as much as you can tell as an expert, but an outsider who goes in and out, what should concern us? What should we be thinking should be done? How can people help preserve this fabulous historical treasure?
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. I think one thing that would be really good is if local people, and maybe they're not highly educated people, but if people in the remote parts of China were switched on to the value, the historical value, the artistic value of their heritage, when these things are dug up, you know, they will be, you know, first of all, they will alert the right authorities. Second of all, they'll put pressure on the authorities to make sure that the objects, well, if possible, that the tomb is correctly excavated, or tomb or site, whatever it is. If not, that at least, you know, there can be some kind of salvage. Archaeology and objects could go into a local museum. Thousands of new museums are being built in China, and that's also a directive from the center.
People will get to know that there's a place to take the treasure to, just as they do in Britain and other places
exactly,
in the world.
Exactly. New museums, which right now are quite empty, many of them, but they will be filled with all this kind of local material, they're being built on the kind of official sites in large towns. I mean, many of these towns are probably have 1 million people in them. I mean, they might be bigger than a place like Dublin, you know. But they will build a new kind of official zone with offices, and they will put a big new museum there.
Is there any way you could describe the sorts of treasures that are being found? Some are being looted or lost. But what are we talking about here? Is it bits of gold, clay, figures?
Totally depends on the date and the quality of the tomb. I mean, some of the more spectacular finds recently have been from Ming Dynasty royal family. So, and there's going to be a wonderful exhibition at the British Museum in a couple of years' time of art from the early 15th century, which will include lots of fabulous gold and jewels, including bits of gold which says, you know, gold from the Western Seas. It's an ingot from Africa. That's the kind of most spectacular level. That obviously has been properly documented and excavated. But other materials, yeah, they could just be pottery figurines and all kinds of things in between. Depends at what date, but people were putting different things into tombs.
But one gets a picture of a country just loaded with bits that you could pick up and put in your pocket. I suppose it's not really like that.
Yes. But well, if you walk around the flea markets and you know, the markets in places like Beijing and Shanghai, there's just so much. I mean, a lot of it is junk, but, you know, it might be very old junk.
And therefore important in some way or more.
Well,
important.
Some historical value. I mean, some of these things are very obscure, kind of strange. You just don't know what they are because you've never seen anything like it before. But anything that is kind of recognized as being of major historical or artistic value is going to end up in a museum, one hopes.
Thank you so much. Just fascinating listening to you. Shane McCausland, senior lecturer again in the history of Chinese art at SOAS right here in London. Thank you.
Thanks.
It wasn't you, the angel on my mind. In the end, I wasn't sad to leave behind. Time in mind should be an easy thing to do. Time in mind, you're not in a cell, there ain't no screws, but you'll find your conscience giving.
That was the Two Bears with their song time in mind. Coming up in the next half hour, I'm going to be talking with Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, and get his take on some fabulous London exhibits he's been seeing. We're also going to hear why NASA has received a record number of astronaut applications since the 1970s anyway. But first, here's the news with our Nick Kelly.
Thanks very much, Nancy. Syrian forces thrust into the rebellious city of Homs today, killing as many as 100 civilians, and Turkey appear to be preparing a new diplomatic push against President Bashar al-Assad. Greek parties are trying to agree a reform deal in return for a new EU-IMF rescue to avoid a chaotic default after repeated delays which have prompted warnings that the euro can live without Athens. The new president of the Maldives have stressed that he did not take power in the Indian Ocean resort islands in a coup, but the ousted president, credited with bringing democracy to the Indian Ocean island, said he was forced out of power at gunpoint. At least 10 tribesmen were killed in northern Yemen during clashes with Shiite rebels today, less than 2 weeks before a presidential election aimed at ending a year of unrest. Supporters and exiled Tibetans gathered in Taipei today to pray for Tibet, where a series of self-immolations and sporadic protests have prompted China to step up security. In the Somali capital, Mogadishu, a suspected suicide car bomber killed at least 9 people today near a hotel where lawmakers often gather. European air safety officials have extended checks for Airbus A380 wing cracks to the entire Super Jumbo fleet and said the widespread defects could pose a safety risk if left unremedied. Romania's Prime Minister-designate Mihai Răzvan Ungureanu named his cabinet today, replacing all ruling party ministers in an attempt to make a clean break from his predecessor, who quit after protests against austerity. And millions of voters went to the polls in India's most populous and politically important state today, the first stage of an election that tests support for Prime Minister Manmohan Singh's troubled government ahead of a nationwide vote in 2 years. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
I'm joined in the studio now with our culture editor, Robert Bound.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Robert. Nice to see you.
Nice to be in the studio with you again.
Excellent.
If I may say.
And I'm very jealous of you because you have been to see the Lucian Freud exhibit ahead of everybody else.
Yes, it's a nice thing. I don't know whether it's going to see Lucian Freud's portraits at the National Gallery warm you up on such a cold day as this in London. They're a little, as you know, they're grey, they're moody, but
gnarly.
They're also majestic. Exactly. But they don't necessarily warm the cockles of your heart. Maybe something more. Maybe they warm the cockles of your soul instead. So I feel honoured to have seen the Freud show at the National Portrait Gallery this morning.
Can you just take us around the exhibit a little bit?
Well,
it's big, you say.
Yeah, first of all, I'd say it's a nice, plain, non-didactic way of displaying Freud. It's the walls are grey, the walls are white. It's much like the backgrounds that he painted, certainly in his later life. It's a good, plain show of his amazing portraits. Obviously, he was best known for that. Were his meat and drink. There's no particular focus. It's an amazing retrospective. It's a survey of each individual stage of his career from just pre-war. Where he had that signature style of the big eyes and a very kind of almost like a, some of them look like stained glass windows. They certainly look like sort of religious iconographic portraiture, right up to Big Sue, as we lovingly call her, benefits inspector.
Lying on the
couch.
Which
was one of the most expensive and famous works of art sold at auction in the last 5 years. So it's an amazingly full show. Sandy Nairn, director of the Portrait Gallery, and his curators have obviously pulled in some amazing favours, and rightfully so. And it seems strange. It seems like amazing timing. Freud is only recently departed, to have such a big retrospective of him on home soil for him in London.
And he, in fact, worked on this show. He should have been here.
Yes, exactly. I don't know whether Freud would have turned up to his own opening, of course, but certainly, yeah. I mean, he was working right up till the end. It feels strange in some of those rooms. You feel like the paint's still a little wet on the canvas.
Are his paintings ever pretty? And that's a leading question. I always find them disturbing, and they pull you in and almost frighten you. He looks right inside into eyes and bones, it seems.
Yeah, it seems. I mean, I think I don't know whether they necessarily are pretty. I don't know whether, I think beauty was possibly something that was more in his eyes as a younger man than as an older man. But what they are is they're certainly even straight. Some of them are, there's an erotic charge in a lot of these pictures. We know that he has a lot of children. We know that he has a lot of children that he knows the names of, perhaps some of that he didn't. And there's a lot of sex and a lot of dirt and a lot of, you know, I mean, most of his subjects were painted in his studio in Holland Park. And they are the bit of West London that was not niceified by Richard Curtis, whose wife, I think, is a Freud as well. Uh-huh. Yeah, so they're not necessarily pretty, but there's something necessary about these things. They pull you in. And there's room after room after room of them. It's a big show. They use the biggest space you can use in the National Portrait Gallery. It really is a sort of labyrinthine show. But all of it, every room brings a sort of fresh perspective. As I say, it's nice and plainly done too.
Opens tomorrow and runs for little while.
That's a very good question. It'll be on until at least the late spring, I'm sure, if anyone's coming to London and wants to visit it. It's certainly their sort of blockbuster show until the early summer, I'd have thought, at the very least, and if not for the rest of the year.
And any of those lucky visitors to London have lots of other things to choose from.
We don't want to be too London-centric on Monocle 24 and Midori House, as you know, Nancy. But I have to say, there's such an embarrassment of riches in London at the moment. We talked about, or in the show previously in the last couple of weeks, I've talked about the big Hockney landscape show, A Bigger Picture, which is on at the Royal Academy, which is totally different. They were old buddies, or are, until Freud passed away, old buddies, both of them painted each other. The Hockney show is a big, bright, optimistic thing. Opposite of the Freud show, it's all landscapes. There's not a single person in any of Hockney's pictures.
Did you love it, the Hockney? Because I didn't hear you talk about it.
The Hockney show, yeah, I thought it was, as I say, I thought it was just, it's always difficult because it's such a different space, those big Rococo grandiose rooms of the Royal Academy. But to fill it with trees, whether they're in summer, spring, autumn or winter, is kind of an amazing feat. Hockney's not scared of using the colours that, you know, we might shy away from for describing these landscapes, most of which are these landscapes around Bridlington in Yorkshire, where he's from, where he's returned to since he moved back from Los Angeles. Also the British Museum, the Hodge show, which is amazing. We had the curator of that show on, I think, on the Globalist a couple of weeks ago, and the Grayson Perry, if you're still in town, at the British Museum as well. It's called The Tomb of the Unknown Craftsman. I think that's got another week or two to run. But that's a phenomenal show. And it's the classic idea of contemporary artist challenges himself by looking at works from the British Museum's collection, which go right back to sort of Stone Age things.
Well, so
there's a thing in London which is, at the moment, which seems very rich. So get out of the cold and get into an often free space.
Cy Twombly, do you want to mention?
Cy Twombly, yeah. Also, Ekin and McLean, who are two gallerists who used to be experts in modern and impressionist art at Christie's. They set up a gallery 6 years ago in New York, and they've just opened a London space. Their opening was on Monday, this Monday night, and it opens with a loan show, so a non-selling show, which is a funny thing to do when you're a commercial gallery, to do a loan show. So it's a sort of goodwill, look at all the people we know and look at a good taste kind of show. Of Cy Twombly, who passed away last year, again, a contemporary of Jasper Johns and Rauschenberg and these sorts of people. It's a beautiful thing, and the jury's obviously still out. It's always a good conversation piece. What on earth was Cy Twombly really thinking?
Excellent. And I always like your music picks, and you have a song.
Yes, well,
after
hearing about all that modern and contemporary art, we're going to change it up a bit. We're going to play something a bit electro. This is new from New York. It's from their first album. They did a sort of remixes album last year. They're Tan Lines. There they are, Nancy. What do you think of those two men on the cover?
They look like two men on the cover. They are black and white.
All right, okay. Photo. They look like two men to me.
They don't look like they have a tan or tan.
You can tell
lines.
Nancy's a married woman, can't you? They're just two men to me. I don't look at men like that.
Am I supposed to think they're
No, you're not.
The one on the right is a bit more.
I'm not saying anything. I just wondered what you thought. It's a bit of a plain album. Anyway, so this is Mixed Emotions. This is the second track off the record. The record's called Mixed Emotions. It's out in a couple of weeks. And this is a song called All of Me.
That was Tan Lines with All of Me. Coming up, why NASA is being swamped with astronaut applications, and we'll find out what's on at the Berlin Film Festival right after this.
Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. And also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes.
Every month, Monocle deploys over 70 writers and photographers to over 50 countries to deliver our print edition. Covering a unique mix of global affairs, business, culture and design, Monocle publishes 10 magazine editions a year and 2 special newspapers during the summer and winter holiday seasons. With a subscription to Monocle, you'll not only be the first to receive the magazine, you'll also be invited to special events and receive our iconic tote bag from Rutote of Japan. Subscribe to Monocle from £80 sterling at our website at shop.monocle.com/subscriptions. Subscribe to Monocle and keep an eye on the world.
The gold and silver bears are about to be handed out in Berlin. The city's International Film Festival gets underway on Thursday with lots of world premieres and feature films, documentaries and shorts competing for prizes. Festival Program Manager Thomas Heiler is on the line now from Berlin. Good evening to you.
Good evening.
Why don't you start by telling us what makes your festival special?
I think what makes the Berlinale very, very special is the deep relationship with the audience we have. Last year we sold about 300,000 tickets in these 10 days and had something like 500,000 admissions to our theaters. So I think that's a very, very special thing that we have this huge marketplace, lots of world premieres, but all this is based on a fantastic audience which we are nurturing with good film since 62 years.
And who's in the audience? Are they your local people from all
regular over? People, yeah. We have various program platforms, we call them sections, and there is a section for young audience, for example, and there kids from the age of 4 can see short film programs and get an introduction into the world of cinema.
Fantastic. And are they mostly Germans and local neighboring countries and then branching out to people from around the world?
I mean, it's both. We have a strong support, but the 300,000 tickets we are talking about, these are sold tickets to regular people like you and me.
Exciting. Wonderful. Okay, and you have loads of premieres, 18, I think, on your list?
We have, in our official competition, we have 18 world premieres, indeed. All of the films that are in competition are world premieres this year.
The ones that are getting a lot of ink are... Take Angelina Jolie and her Bosnian drama In the Land of Blood and Honey. Farewell, My Queen is another one.
Yeah.
Marie Antoinette we're reading about.
That Farewell, My Queen is the one we are opening with it. And this has Diane Kruger and Léa Seydoux, and it's a wonderful opening film. It plays the French Revolution from the point of view of the people, of the servants who work there. And that's it's a historical piece, but it's beautifully shot, and it's very actual as well.
And it's a premiere, a world premiere, right?
Yes, it is.
But you've had a chance to look at it yourself in order to get it into your house to show.
Yes, of course. I mean, yeah. Our festival starts selecting films by the beginning of by mid-October, and we to get these. All in all, we are screening 380 films. So we have 380 slots, and for that we saw about a bit less than 6,000 submissions, long and short films.
Is there something about Farewell, My Queen that made you want to open with it? Well, obviously there must have been.
Yes, I mean, it has everything you need to seduce an audience in the beginning. It's a beautiful and very clear story. It's great acting, and it's an issue. This is we see Marie Antoinette in her palace, but it could also be one of the Maghreb emperors or heads of governments who have been chased away during the years. I think the view of power and power when it comes to its end is a very universal thing, and this is what was very nicely portrayed in this film.
Could you surprise us? Tell us about some of the... You must have a surprise there, or in the sense that there is one you think we're going to be really excited about when we discover, but we just don't know about it yet.
I mean, the whole competition this year is on the one hand, the obvious things you just mentioned, star-loaded films, which are premiering internationally or worldwide within the competition. But we also have a strong lineup of young authors, young directors being born in the 1970s. And there's something that I personally find very exciting is Postcards from the Zoo, an Indonesian film from the filmmaker Edwin. It's his second feature, actually. And this is something where we are really glad that we can offer it to our audience, but also to the world community as something you really to discover.
Well, look, last year you did just that with the Iranian film,
Didn't we?
A Separation. Yeah. Do you think Postcards from the Zoo might be this year's Separation?
This one, or Just the Wind, a very exciting Hungarian film who deals with a painful reality, political reality, what is done to gypsy people in Hungary, or the film by Ursula Mayer, Swiss filmmaker, a female director who has a very great portrayal of a very unusual young family.
You make this sound very exciting. I wish I were going to be with you in the audience this week.
Yes, please do so soon.
Thank you so much for telling us about this.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Festival Program Manager Thomas Heiler on the line from Berlin.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, ja, Jorgensen.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet, Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I met the Monocle 24.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, it seems that more Americans, since the late 70s anyway, want to get away from the planet. NASA has been flooded with applications from would-be astronauts. Dwayne Ross is with the Space Center's astronaut recruitment program, and he's on the line now from Houston, Texas. Hello, Mr. Ross.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm very well. How are you?
Great.
What's going on? Why do all these men and women want to take off?
Well, you ask a good question. There's probably two or three reasons, and these are just my guesses. Number one is obvious. Flying in space is a really cool thing to do, and a lot of people would like to do that. But the reason we've had so many applications, we're not sure. We've been in the news a lot lately because of the end of the shuttle program and because of media coverage about our partnerships with the commercial industry. And also, we did a very comprehensive public relations and communications activity to let folks know that we were in the process of selecting again. So I guess all that worked, and we have a huge number of applications to look at, so we're going to be very busy over the next few months.
Do you have any, you know, theories, not just personal theories, but you work inside the business? What do you say inside there about this great interest beyond the fact that you've advertised?
Well, we think it's really good. We're encouraged by the fact that so many people still believe in space exploration, which obviously those of us on the inside do very fervently. So we were happy with that response. With the end of the shuttle program, it seemed that a number of people thought that NASA was going to be out of the space travel business, which was not the case at all. And so I think this kind of indicates that a lot of people understand that we're still exploring, we're still planning on exploring in the future.
Do you think there could be any sort of a, this could be a, not a sort of a hit back, but be, in this tough economic climate we're in, do you think young people are just looking in new directions? Could it be connected at all? You know, jobs are hard to find. Let's go to space?
It could be, but we were pretty straight up front with people in that we indicated early on that we're only going to be selecting a handful of people, somewhere in the 10 to 15 range. So it's very, very competitive at best, and certainly with this larger number, it's even going to be more competitive. But that could be the case.
So
it's one more job, and it's a cool job.
It's a really cool job, I think, to a lot of people. And so you're saying about a dozen or so people are going, or 6,300 people are going after about a dozen jobs.
Correct.
How on earth are you going to pick them? I mean, what are your top three things you got to have in a good to make a good astronaut?
Well, one of the top three things that you have to have just to start is you have to be a United States citizen to be a NASA astronaut. Obviously, we have a lot of international partners that we fly with, but they belong to their own countries. They're not NASA astronauts. You have to have a degree in engineering, math, or science. That's been our requirement since the very first astronauts were selected. And you have to have some reasonable experience that would indicate that you can do this this kind of operational, technical, hands-on, practical work that astronauts are asked to do. And you have to be a good team player. If you're not a team player, then this is not the job for you.
And could you tell us something about the demographics, like male, female applicants? You know, are they from all over the country? Who's applying?
We don't know yet.
Okay.
In the past, certainly the folks have been from all over the country, and we've had a fairly good mix of males and females and folks from the minority groups, which is exactly what we would like to have. Right now, what we have is a number. We haven't even seen the pieces of paper yet. They're supposed to be here shortly. They have to travel through several iterations of computer systems to get to us, so we're still waiting anxiously to start looking at the stack. So we don't know what the demographics are yet.
And Mr. Ross, those who are successful, you hire your 10 or 12 or 15 people, what sorts of work are they going to be doing right away? Where would they be flying, possibly?
What they'll be doing right away is going into a two-year basic training program, which includes a lot of things. And it includes things like flying in airplanes. We do space flight readiness training in high-performance airplanes. In order to fly in space, it'd be good to know if you can fly on the ground or close to the ground. And so they'll be doing things like land survival training, water survival training, and then some basic flight familiarization for those people who aren't already aviators. They'll be doing spacecraft systems training for the International Space Station. They'll be doing extravehicular activity, the spacewalk training in our big, huge pool that we have for that purpose. They'll be doing robotics training to operate the remote arm that we use on the space station. Matter of fact, there's more than one remote arm on the space station that they use to operate things outside the space station. They'll be taking Russian language training. They'll be doing Earth resources familiarization and a lot of other basic familiarization in a number of disciplines.
Wow.
So it's going to be a very busy couple of years for these folks.
Okay, and just to have a bit of pie in the sky, if the sky really were the limit, where do people want to go these days? What's the buzz in the circles
Mars.
At NASA?
Everybody
Mars?
Wants to go to Mars. I've been wanting to go to Mars since I've got the NASA, and I've been here for a long time.
Why do you want to go to Mars?
Because, well, from just a basic standpoint, you have to explore. You have to go. You have to go over the next hill and see what's there. And Mars is our closest neighbor, and right now seems to be the most similar to Earth. So we just need to go see what's there and what's been there and why things are like they are.
And let's say, just continuing with the fantasy, let's say that, you know, you do start to move towards a program to go to Mars. How far off would that be, do you think?
Yikes, I don't even know, but it's a lot of years. I'm an old guy, so it may not be in my lifetime, but certainly we need to get started to press on to go to Mars. And one way you can do that is go to the moon first and establish a base, because it's easier to go beyond the moon than it is to go beyond the gravitational pull of Earth. But it's years. It's years away. 20 years, 30 years, who knows?
I like your enthusiasm, and I've got to ask you a question. We had a little argument in the studio the other day about whether it's Houston or Houston.
Oh, it's Houston.
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 Me
Houston,
too.
Texas.
I just won that I won that bet.
Good for you.
Houston. Okay, well, Houston, I hope you don't have a problem. And I hope you get some really great decisions made for all these people who want jobs. And thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, glad to do it.
All the best.
Goodbye now.
Bye-bye. Duane Ross is with NASA with their astronaut recruitment program.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 no gigantes.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Você está escutando a Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
That's it for the Wednesday edition of Midori House. My producer was Marcus Hippy. Fernando Augusto Pacheco was on research, and our studio manager was Toby Harmond. In 3 hours, the Monocle Daily will look at why U.S. countries are relocating back to the States from China. That's at 2200 London time. The Daily will also look at which building in the world leans the most. Headlines are next, and that's going to be followed by the entrepreneurs. I'm Nancy Durham. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.